the authority making the budget and setting the limits also pays all the costs. Thus, a single program such as Medicare can set a global budget, although it has, and so can a socialized medical system such as the Canadian one, where the government is the sole payer. But in a pluralistic system like ours, even just identifying the totality of expenditures in the healthcare sector is virtually impossible. And if you really identified it, how do you pick a limit? 5% more last year, 20% less? Who makes the decision? Based on what criteria or set of values? After all, what gets paid for and how much is paid have profound effects on the practice of medicine in the state, on the recruitment and retention of providers, introduction of technology, etc. Under SB 83, the Health Resources Authority decides, and so must bear all responsibility for the consequences. Since the future success or failure or growth or shrinkage of healthcare services and costs will no longer be a market phenomenon, but instead a result of the authority's central planning and control of the entire healthcare system, we all know the fate of centralized planning. The greatest experiment in centralized planning in the history of the planet collapsed under its own weight last year, and the republics of the former Soviet Union are now struggling to reintroduce market forces and privatization into their society. Healthcare systems, even in Alaska legislature debates, is moving precisely in the opposite direction, considering SB 83. Besides, global budgeting cannot work fairly when the entity making the budget does not pay all the costs of the system, or pays only a small portion. SB 83 calls for control of all health expenditures in the state of Alaska. All health expenditures. How can it control the cost of the substantial federal health program in the state, such as Medicare, the VA, the military, the Native Health Service, over which it has no jurisdiction? Obviously, it cannot. But it doesn't even propose seeking waivers from the federal government to do so. How can it control the cost of out-of-state care delivered to and paid for by Alaska? It can't. These sources of care cumulatively account for at least a quarter of the total annual health expenditures in our state. And ending with 3/4 of the pie is not exactly global. SB 83 must receive a failing grade for its global accounting because it ignores substantial expenditures in adding up the state's total health care tab. The authority confines itself principally to SB 83's real targets, hospitals and physicians. Just for starters, the bill omits the following important categories of health expenditures. I don't want to bore you, but I think you need to hear what it omits. First and foremost, the cost of Gargantuan Alaska State Health Resources Authority, for which you will be obligated to appropriate funds every year. The profits and overhead expenses of health insurance company. All public health programs. Land acquisition, facility construction, mortgage costs, or the recoupment for federal and state facilities. As an example, which was mentioned before, the $120 million that will be spent for a new Native Medical Center will not appear in their annual operating budget, ever. Private sector cost figures do include these big ticket items. Reimbursement to dentists, dental hygienists, chiropractors, naturopaths, physical therapists, occupational therapists, psychologists, private duty nurses, nurse practitioners, nurse midwives, physician assistants, podiatrists, optometrists, opticians, acupuncturists, naturopaths, homeopaths. I'm getting tired. If you don't include them at the outset, which SB 83 does not, it's certainly not global. If you do include them, I suspect it would be a bureaucratic nightmare to implement what the bill demands. Now, for the moment, let's assume that the Health Resources Authority, by some miracle, identifies these costs and sets expenditure limits in each category. It still treats the private sector unfairly compared to the public sector. SB 83 would regulate the incomes of only those providers in the private sector, and would do nothing to regulate the cost of all the public sector doctors or hospitals. For global budgeting to have any meaning, all providers must have their reimbursement subject to the same control, whether by restricting fee, reducing salaries, or eliminating positions. To single out only reimbursements for fee-based private sector providers and ignore the public sector is not only denying the formal equal protection of the law that Harlan mentioned, but effectively scuttles the whole global budgeting concept. But that's what SB 83 proposes. The private sector will be held hostage to the inefficiencies and spending habits of the public sector, since the target limit expenditures are based on the total of both sectors. How about the rate-setting portion of SB 83? What has been the experience with rate its effect on the availability of providers and access to care. I mean much simpler rate setting, not tied to global expenditures like SB 83. In New York, the physical plants and capital equipment of hospitals have been eroded. The level of care they provided is now being jeopardized. In Massachusetts, while costs have been kept down, access has become a problem, as physicians have left the state in droves, and you could call the state and verify that. And many have retired early because of placing constraints on medical practice by the state, basically our price controls. Many physicians say they no longer can afford to practice because of an unrealistic reimbursement level, and a physician shortage exists. In Connecticut, the proposed rate setting precipitated a vigorous hospital lobbying campaign that resulted in a hefty rate increase. Wisconsin tried hospital rate setting beginning in 83, but abolished its commission in 1987 because it was ineffective and because individual legislators were constantly introducing exceptions for hospitals in their own districts. And if Washington State, having experimented with hospital rate setting in the early 80s, abolished its rate setting commission in the late 80s also because it was ineffective. In Alaska, which already has difficulty attracting and retaining physicians, rate setting will probably cause many early retirements and discourage the recruitment of new physicians. This will be particularly crippling outside of Anchorage and Fairbanks. Community hospitals now on the brink, I suspect, would have to close their doors. Why are physicians so vigorously opposed to Alaska's government, or any government for that matter, becoming involved in setting their fees? Well, it has to do with the shared experience they've all had with Medicare, the ultimate health care big brother. It has made them profoundly distrustful of any government's ability or willingness or promise to regulate fees equitably. We've already seen how a program driven only by budgetary considerations, have adverse effect on the practice of medicine, the access to care. I can go through the whole RBRBS section with you and what it's done to the physician community. It split the physician community along surgeon and in the profession, and family practitioners, and internists, etc., but I'm not going to bore you with those details. Suffice to say that 34 cents in this state today is the reimbursement to a physician on the dollar for Medicare. We've received a great number of calls in our office in the last 3 weeks from patients saying, this physician will not see me. Many can no longer take new Medicare patients, because now they're being reimbursed sometimes as much as 30 to 35 cents below the cost that it takes to care of those patients, and that's getting into cost shift. In addition, but in June 1991, 6 months before this RBRBS was to go into effect, Medicare published its rules in the Federal Register. It transpired that Medicare had used 12-year-old census data to plug into its formula. In Alaska, when they figured the data that the physicians would be paid on, they picked the year 1983 to determine what the medical liability dollars were, and they picked the year 1987 for the economic factor. Well, in 1983, the cost of malpractice insurance was reasonable. It's gone up 440% since that time. So doctors are very reluctant to trust any system that functions that way. What is RBRBS, a la Medicare, or a la SB 83 going to do for access to services? For one thing, as I just mentioned, several large internal medicine practices now have stopped seeing patients. But let me take you through a quick scenario so that you can put it in a practical sense. When I was speaking to an internist the other day, he told me that he'd have to pay more for a plumber to make a simple repair, and he could get paid for admitting a sick old lady to Providence in the middle of the night. Well, like welfare Cadillac stories, I wondered about this. So I checked it out. I called a few plumbers and asked what it would cost to replace the circulating pump on my furnace on a Saturday night. The answer, $90 an hour with a 2-hour minimum, counting time to and from the shop plus $77.50 for the pump, for a total of $257.50. Then I consulted the RBRBS manual. I looked up the code that would apply to spending 4 hours admitting an old lady dehydrated with pneumonia.
I'm going to jump in here.
Not counting time to and from home. A total of, say, 5 hours of a physician's time in the middle of the night. They would collect $121.18. And if the physician sees the patient one or two more times the next day, They don't get any more. It's still $121.18.
Doctor?
Here is the only program paying below its share of cost. Providers can still manage to see their elderly Medicare patients because they can still charge you and me, their other patients, more than the Medicare's 34 cents on the dollar. That's called cost shifting. But if all services were reimbursed at Medicaid rates as proposed in the Congressional Budget Office document...
Can I jump in or do you want to?
Doctor?
...would have to close their office because their revenues would fall below their expenses. Based solely on Medicare's projection of 1996 reimbursements, many physicians will close their offices. This is real. This is not just a story because I represent physicians. It's not a threat or a joke. Doctors don't work out of the front room of their homes anymore as they did when we were kids. They pay rents, staff salaries, malpractice insurance, business liability insurance, unemployment insurance, phone bills, fax bills, office supply expenses, accounting expenses, computer costs, business property taxes, just like the rest of us. No doctor could survive seeing 100% Medicare patients unless he ran them through his office at the rate of one every 3 minutes, which is no certainty, which is no way certainly to practice medicine. And in states where Medicaid pays even less than Medicare, notorious Medicaid mills have been in existence for years. We're lucky we don't have them here in Alaska. This lengthy explanation, Senator, reveals why doctors are so incredibly wary of government price controls and government promises to, quote, trust us. Spurn. Quite shy. The Alaska State Health Resources Authority adopts RVRVS as SB83 calls for. Would it be any more equitable than Medicare? In our CHIPR proposal, we employ market-based mechanisms to control rising costs. Overall, the opinion of most health economists, Dr. Bartlett's testimony notwithstanding, clearly indicate that rate setting cannot be used as the sole method of cost containment and health system reform. Doing so will lead to profound and sometimes unanticipated dysfunctions elsewhere in the system. Yet, this is precisely what SB 83 sets out to do. As far as I can see, the principal virtue of SB 83 is that it caters to the resentments and frustrations that most people have about the high cost of health care. It bashes doctors and hospitals. It sounds simple and it's easy to find people to testify for it. Just as it would be easy to find people to testify in support of a bill that cuts in half plumber's fees, lawyer's fees, or the cost of your automobile repair. Its main defects are that it's a quick fix. It's not adequately tied to any other health or measure, and it will make the entire healthcare system much, much worse. The most important person we talk about, that's the patient. In addition, Senator, I watched 4 hours of television last night. It was on public television, which Mr. Donahue narrated, and also 2 hours of Nightline. On those two programs were the most famous economists and government leaders in health reform this nation has, and including Canada, and nowhere in that 4 hours of discussion that I hear anything that even smacked of what SB 83 talks about. I would be more than happy to send that to any of you senators who like to invest the time. Of course, now I know you don't have any, but it was an interesting scenario. I appreciate you allowing me to take all this time, Senator. And I thank you.
Fine. Thank you, Ray. Are there any questions of Mitch Shallow? The Senator?
Yeah, Ray, Sam Cotton here. I'll give you the name of my plumber. I called the other night. My home's in Eagle River, and the thermocoupler went out. I called a plumber, and he said it'd be $75. It was midnight on a Saturday night. And I asked him what it would be if I waited till the next morning. He said it'd be $25 cheaper. So, but I also have, as you know, a wife who occasionally ventures off to the emergency room in the middle of the night, and I think she's underpaid as well. So, my only suggestion here is to shop around on your plumbers a little better.
With the results of getting sued, that those figures were quoted to me by Central Plumbing in Haiti.
I thought you'd been talking. No. I could tell a plumbing story of one Christmas night when it was eve and it was 35 degrees below, and I'll tell you, that plumber looked like Santa Claus. I don't know what he charged, but he earned it. Are there other questions of Mr. Shallow? All right, Ray, I'm going to ask you too. how do you feel we move ahead in light of the fact that there's a great deal of dissent and disharmony about approaches? Suggestions do you have for us?
I really concur with Dr. Wilson. I think that it's going to take more than just those assemble. I think the legislature is going to have to spend some money and find an economist, the health economist, that actually can be on staff for some period of time. This is such a complex issue, and we have to quit politicizing it. It'll never be solved, because as you well know, and you're in the middle of this, then it becomes emotional, and we need to take that piece out of this problem.
Fine. Thank you. We'll now go to Homer and Mary Raymond.
Senator, in light of the questions that you asked concerning the health task force, which I certainly am in awe in all the effort that they have done and what they have produced, you asked the question if you thought that they could or prepare legislation. And in light of the various bills that are before you now addressing the whole problem, is it possible that with the task force and with the HES committee that these bills be tabled or whatever it is that you do, and that the A bill that is truly comprehensive be put forward?
Fine. Thank you for your comments. One of the problems of a single bill is a problem, a constitutional one, of single subject rule, so that does create a problem on that. But thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions? We did have Clinton Gray at Norton Sound, but I did get a teleconference message that he's going to be submitting written testimony, and so is not online. Is that correct? Do we have anyone on the teleconference system that has not had an opportunity to be heard? Apparently, we do not have anyone. Is there anyone in the room that wishes to give testimony? I didn't have anybody signed up. Yes, would you join us? Welcome. Identify yourself, please.
Steve Brun, Aetna Insurance Company. And thank you, Senator Sturgiluski, other senators. I would like to specifically make some comments on certain aspects of Senate Bill 83, particularly those relating to the accessibility issue, and I guess in particular relating to Section 87-120, that being an area, I guess, most germane to the insurance industry, since it does relate to access and availability and procurement of insurance.
That's page 10.
Yes. And Aetna certainly, as both a corporate position and here in Alaska, supports the goal of making healthcare affordable. We've been actively working with legislators on several bills that accomplish some portion of that task. Bills introduced by Senators Fertula and Collins. And maybe just to give you a little perspective on that, I've done a little pie chart that I guess puts that into a little bit of visual context. Aetna's feeling is that our first focus certainly ought to be on the uninsured population. Obviously, that's a diverse population, has varying characteristics, certain aspects of that being easier to solve than others. But we feel that in solving the healthcare issues, that we should first focus on the most needy and try and close those most critical gaps. In looking at this chart I've done, this represents the uninsured population. And you'll see that what we have done is within that population indicated those segments that could be helped by some of the other existing bills that are available. That's a pool of possible enrollees. Obviously, the structure of the various bills will determine actual enrollment in those plans. But you see that insured population, about half of them, can gain some access, or at least availability, to the private healthcare system or through some insurance vehicle through existing bills. One other item I should mention is that of that insured population, fully 4 in 10 have earnings in excess of 300% of the poverty limit. So two ways to look at that. In one sense, those individuals may have an ability to pay, and for them it really may be something of a pure access issue related to existing insurance practices, group or individual plans related to underwriting. Other than that, those may be individuals who just pay their way as they go and shouldn't really be a primary focus. So when you're looking at that 54% who aren't necessarily covered by existing bills, some of those folks, they're making a personal choice for whatever reason, and meeting their needs shouldn't be a concern of ours. However, that does leave, even with these bills, a certain residual group, and I guess in some ways that's the legislative dilemma. There will be a population, poor, without available economic resources, who at some point in the system, political decisions are going to be need to be made as to how to bring coverage to them. Our feeling is that what we ought to do is try to preserve what works. Most folks are insured under the present system, that we try and strengthen the system, and that we not substitute private systems, public solutions. We feel that there is ways that we can expand private coverage. Certainly the insurance industry has recognized that one of the great and growing availability gaps is for small insurers, and we've taken what we feel are some significant, dramatic steps to close that gap, to reform our own market practices. I should say as an aside, too, that we recognize that we need to become more efficient, that we need to keep our overhead costs, even though they represent perhaps only 8 cents on a dollar, as lean as possible. And we are certainly working on a national basis towards consolidated claim forms. We have, within Aetna, a large task force of technicians working on a global electronic claim submission system. And we agree that those are important steps, both for the fact that they will help reduce some costs, but also that there's a lot of frustration in the system, and we'd like to try and help reduce some of that hassle factor. So we agree with those. The concern we have with Senate Bill 83 as it relates to affordability is that it appears, I guess in some ways, we're not sure what powers are going to be invested in the authority. It is very short on details. The whole access section constitutes 24 lines of the bill. Some folks have read into that that it lays the foundation for a single-payer system. We don't think that would be a reasonable or a smart approach to go. In any event, in some ways it seems to generally try to provide access. I point out that we already have certain legislation that tries to target specific solutions for specific populations at risk. The authority certainly has, under the terms of the bill, very broad powers and discretion, and whatever the, I guess, intentions of it might be, we certainly have concerns about how it's going to be executed. It seems that the details are really left to this central authority. Our concern is that will lead to the creation of additional bureaucracies to solve what in large part may be solved through private sector solutions. I guess two issues that it seems to presume that public sector involvement is necessary, both in terms of some of the uninsured populations, as well as in a sense getting involved in a way in competing with the private industry. In that regard, that it would also set up mechanisms where the state, either as an agent or as a type of insurance broker or as an insurer itself, would be spending resources and allocating monies to provide health insurance to individuals and groups that already have that coverage. There are several states now, and admittedly these are in the early stages, but Kansas, Ohio, and other states where the private sector itself, businesses, business associations with insurers, are themselves developing pooling arrangements so that small employers or employer associations can take advantage of some of the benefits that large employers have. We would recommend that the insurance industry, with legislative assistance, work directly with employers to try and structure those types of pools, rather than having an authority serving as an intermediary and focusing its issue in that regard, and we can better be addressing those most in need. We have concerns, too, about the fact that the bill would seem to allow the state to become a self-insurer, self-administrator of plans as it deems fit. That has lots of implications in terms of the staffing that's needed, actuaries, administrators, technicians of various sorts, in terms of the fiduciary responsibilities that that would create, and whether or not it would come to pass. The question is that a best role or an appropriate role for the state government to become some sort of state insurance or provider bureaucracy? I guess what I'd like to reiterate is that we feel that certainly more than insignificant changes are needed. We would ask, though, that where the private sector can provide a solution, that we be given that opportunity. And where there is an issue that isn't really solved through existing mechanisms, that be the focus. Although I wasn't an official member and wasn't a voting member, I spent many weekends up in Anchorage this winter and attended all the task force meetings. And one thing I was struck by, since many of these issues were somewhat new to me, is that that it's a very long and massive learning curve. I think the task force had a commitment, made great progress on that learning curve. I think most would agree that there still is much more to know, and thereby would have some concerns about, at this point, codifying the progress that's been made to date in a health insurance authority that would still be left at discretion to make many fundamental decisions. I guess I would agree with other speakers that we've learned a lot more, but in some ways that shows us how much more we need to learn in terms of the interactive nature of this and the extreme complexities of it.
Fine. Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. Are there any questions of the committee? Was there anyone else that... thank you very much. Yes, Commissioner? Welcome. You're spending a lot of time.
Well, this is an important issue, Madam Chairman. For the record, this is Nancy Usera, Commissioner of the Department of Administration. I appreciated the opportunity to come and listen to all of the comments that have been made. As we indicated, I wish Senator Duncan were here because I'm always uncomfortable with a he said, she said kind of scenario. We've had ongoing discussions with his office on this legislation, and I will try to reiterate what some of those conversations have been and summarize a little more what we said yesterday with regard to some of these proposals, and that is that we see this as a work in progress. The Department of Administration was one of three who participated on the healthcare task force. The work that's been done within that body is important, but it was a finite group. You know, there was a limited number of people who represented various aspects of the healthcare community. And participated in it, and I think that this public airing of these issues are going to be important as we go forward and get broader participation, and certainly we have several thresholds that we're going to have to cross in determining how the state wants to go in providing both access and cost containment to health care in the state. To let Mr. Knutson off the hook, I wish I didn't have to be sitting through this. You know, our involvement from a departmental standpoint, Department of Administration standpoint, is that this authority was placed within that umbrella to administer the authority. And you have to ask the question why, and I guess that it certainly, we would be supportive. We think that it should lie with the agency that is the expert in the area, and that certainly would be Health and Social Services. But having said that, we are involved and have been participating in this. One of the things from an administration, and now speaking, I guess, for the group of us who have been participating in these discussions, Department of Health and Social Services, Admin, and Department of Commerce, that is the Division of Insurance, I think there are a couple of things that we have to decide collectively as a state from a public policy standpoint, and that is whether or not health care should be treated as a utility. And that's basically the kind of approach that we're discussing here, is if health care is a basic service that should be treated not dissimilarly to a utility where the rates are established and the rates are paid and everybody has has a basic level of service, and that's determined, and then we add on to that. If that's the direction that we want to go, I think this is clearly a strong first step. I will also tell you that I personally don't think that that's necessarily the direction that we want to go in. The state has had some experience over the past few years with regard to cost containment issues. We've been real concerned from just a personal services standpoint and a benefit standpoint, so we have a little bit of experience in this. And one of the things, one of the premises that we've gone into looking at our health care coverage for our employees is there is, in fact, an insatiable appetite for health care services, I think, amongst Americans. And certainly this state is no different. But the key to every successful cost containment effort that the state has made, and I will tell you that in the past several years it's been significant, has been placing medical management back into the hands of the individual. Is having some disciplines and having some mechanisms in place that puts a responsibility back on the individual for determining what kind of health care and how much health care they want to have and they want access to. We're not talking about, you know, the emergency in the middle of the night where Johnny falls and breaks his arm and has to go to the emergency room. We're talking about people getting second opinions. We're talking about people making determinations on whether or not it's really necessary to go to the doctor, what kind of treatment options there are, whether or not this is an optional service, you know, the kinds of things about the tracking tonsillectomies and those kinds of things. I don't know about you, but I remember when I had my tonsils out, and it was the fad procedure of that year. I probably would have my tonsils today had it not been. Now, whether or not it was the right thing at the time is probably in the context of this irrelevant. But I think that tracking those things are interesting. But it's not unless we inform consumers and we give them the management opportunity to say, I think this is what I want done to my body or not. But without getting off on that tangent, coming back to the point, is that the successful cost containment measures that we've had are those that have put management of healthcare back into the hands of the individual to make educated decisions. So I think that that component, in particularly SB 83, is missing. Is that this is a situation where we're talking all around the issue and not specifically to the issue of the responsibility of the individual as the key participant in this scenario. Again, we look at this as a work in progress. You don't get anywhere without taking a first step. It may end up being a piece of the ultimate plan that comes out. But as I mentioned yesterday, we are looking at each of these bills as standalone components or standalone pieces that will have to live or die in their own right, because we can't guarantee a package kind of approach. And we don't think that this bill, the way it is right now, would be able to stand a test of standing on its own independently.
Are there questions of the commissioner? Senator?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Commissioner, well, you talked about shifting the responsibility to the patients and making choices and all that, and I agree with that in many ways. Some of the issues on access to health care, I mean, some people have access through Medicaid, and then there are other people that don't have as good access because they're not covered. And the choices that come up, they have no way to take advantage or not. How do you see this coming together? How do you see, should cost containment be in it? Should it not? How do you see the picture?
I guess, Madam Chairman, Senator Menard, I think that from my perspective, and keep in mind that I'm not a stakeholder in this. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't represent any of the communities at stake here. Is to narrow down the issue. This is the old "don't throw the baby out with the bathwater." Is that there are parts of our system that are working very effectively, and I'm not sure that we should be tinkering with those pieces. Let's focus on the piece that we are really trying to get to here. And again, as I mentioned yesterday, in this state, you know, what are the pieces in this state that are broken? If this is a working poor scenario, that the people who are not having access or can't afford insurance, where it is an affordable issue, are those people that are in the chasm between being Medicaid eligible and being employed where you have benefits or something, you know, whether you're covered by BIA or covered by the military program or the state program or something, as we said yesterday, with over 100,000 people in the state covered by state insurance, that's a significant niche right there. But if we're talking about a niche, I'm not sure that we have fully explored what options we have in just expanding our current program. Maybe it is as simple as expanding the eligibility under the Medicaid program. I just think that this is like killing a gnat with a sledgehammer approach, and that if we have specific areas of concern, let's focus on those as opposed to tinkering with the entire system, unless we determine in the end that's absolutely necessary. And again, I just don't feel like we're ready to make that commitment. That I certainly don't feel ready to say that we have fully explored what our options are.
Senator. And just following up on that, is as far as fully exploring our options, then how would you recommend if we go forward? If you could, let's take a hypothetical. If you could drop a plan on how we could move forward and deal with some of the problems that are coming up, how would you do it?
Well, Senator, this is without a great deal of thought, but I would tell you that we have been having some conversations ourselves on just that issue. I think, first of all, we have a commitment from the three departments that have been participating in these discussions to work over the summer and sit down and see about, you know, based on all the information that's come out of the task force, and Dr. Wilson is right, you know, the administration has been an observer and a participant in the table, but we certainly have not taken a leadership role in coming up with what you would call as our proposal for how to address these issues. We've considered ourselves in a data collection, you know, information collecting mode at this point, as I think this committee probably has. We think we're about at the point where we'd like to sit down and start putting pencil to paper and saying let's zero in. So we're looking to do that this summer when we have a little extra time on our hands, and certainly working with the concepts and the proposals that are put out in the existing regulation, taking what we see are the best parts and forging those as well as throwing in some of our own ideas. So for our part, we're anticipating doing that this summer. I think that the task force, and I'll speak for myself because I don't know that there's unanimity on this. I think the task force is a body of people who have a tremendous amount of knowledge now in this area. I think it would be unfortunate to disband that, and then 2 years from now we come back together and say we've got to take on this healthcare issue, and we have to start training people all over again in the basics of the issues. I think that the task force has a body of knowledge that should be drawn upon, and to continue the discussions in this area, and again, refine things. The debate as to whether or not the task force came out with recommendations, I will tell you clearly my view on that was that the task force admittedly endorsed concepts which were released from the task force, if you will, with an endorsement that these have value for further discussion. As a matter of fact, on our closing day, the language of the resolution and the recommendations initially were that these were concepts that the task force was endorsing for immediate enactment of legislation. And there was a fair amount of discussion. And that language was changed to that these were concepts that should be sent out for consideration by the legislature, and that is to open it up to the public process. I think the task force can be used to refine these concepts and to start narrowing it down into specific proposals that will get to specific pieces. I just simply don't think we're there yet. So I think the task force, I think the administration is ready now, and we certainly have an obligation to come up and not just throw stones at things, but to say, here are our ideas on what we think we ought to do. And we feel like we're in a position that we can start doing that now, that Senator Duncan so kindly provided us with all the data and information from the task force. We think the task force needs to consider continue considering some of these specific proposals and narrowing down their focus. And then thirdly, I think it's going to be real important. It was an interesting idea that was brought up on the teleconference this morning, and frankly, I hadn't really thought about it before then, but I think that having key players from these two, from both the House and Senate committees involved in these is important, because you are going to be the people that are going to ultimately be making, working on the specific proposals and forging these into workable packages. And being a full participant in that process at the working stage, I think, is important.
Thank you. Just one other comment is that, you know, we have spent a couple hundred thousand dollars on the task force and stuff, and there is question, depending on what happens to Senate Bill 83, whether the task force should be funded and go forward. And I'm glad to hear that the administration and hopefully the other departments feel that this is a high priority item. And I agree that I think the task force did bring a lot of that into light here, and that we can focus on it. It is a complex problem that many of us do know. But so through this, am I hearing from you that you would give support to funding the task force longer, moving forward with an authority that is part of 83 and fund that? Or can the departments put together a package that would come together? Or is it going to take both?
Three components. We don't think that the authority is ready. I mean, we think that's much too broad a step at this point. We're going to be working on a proposal. I guess the question that maybe I haven't answered. You know, I don't have to do anything but be candid. You know, there is a reluctance on the part of this administration to proliferate task forces, and it's one more task force, and if there is a constructive purpose for this task force, and if truly we can use it as a forum for refining these proposals and coming up with some specific recommendations, and not, you know, I have no problem supporting it. The discussion that we have a final task force meeting, I think in June, comes in June, is the last task force mm-hmm. meeting. Well, I mean, for this,
in this fiscal year, there is going to be a jubilee.
For the record, right?
Yeah.
Thank you. There is going to be one in June, and I think that that's going to be the critical meeting to determine what, you know, for additional funding, you know, for an additional year to go forward, what are they going to do? You know, is the mission going to be to continue talking about concepts and discussing these things, or do we really want to put legislation on the table and have this task force actually participate in developing a legislative package? I've been involved with more task forces than I would like to have to even admit to, and I have yet to see one that has been able to actually put together a specific proposal. So I'm teetering, and this is no surprise to anybody, is that the answer to your question is, I don't know. I don't have a clear vision of what the task force would do right now. I'm almost inclined to say I think it's a good idea to let them stand down, you know, stand at recess for a while, let us work with the legislature and the administration in forging some proposals, and then let the task force come back if we can't do our job as adequately as we should.
Senator Duncan.
Well, just a couple comments. I just walked in on this conversation, so I'm shooting from, you know, not full information, but it appears to me that there is a real, and I've listened to the commissioner's comments, that if the administration believes that some of these proposals need to be fleshed out more, that there is a real charge and a real undertaking that the task force can proceed with. And that would speak for continuation of the task force. The problem with waiting to make that decision in June, Commissioner, is, as you know, unless we go a lot longer in this legislative session than we're intended to go, the decision on funding by the administration has to be made prior to our June task force meeting. But it's clear to me the position that you're taking, if we're not successful in getting 83 through, which is just part of a comprehensive approach. I mean, if we want to piecemeal the rest of it, I guess we do that. And if we want to leave the major component on the table, then that's, you know, we've left the major component on the table, but it's still a piecemeal approach, despite the fact you say it's not. or others say it's not. But it appears to me that there is a real charge for the task force, and that you should be, if you believe that we need to continue to proceed, your recommendation should be to continue with the task force, and let's direct it to do some detailed work on a comprehensive approach, which includes the access portions that everybody seems to be supporting, and includes Senate Bill 83 approach, which also the task force recommended.
I don't want to prolong this at this point. I do feel there's been a tremendous amount of involvement. There are tremendous equities. Those equities are there. They're money and a whole lot of issues that are not going to get any easier, and that, you know, I can't speak to 83's fate at this time, but I think the critical thing is going to be that this process go on and that people come to the table. I have been frankly appalled at you know, some of the anger and the fact we have not been able to get down to what are the basic issues and work together, and I think it's going to be difficult in with the mistrust and so on to make progress, but we have to make progress, and this process cannot stop, and I'm certainly committed to being a part of trying to find solutions. I think it's this issue is not going away. It's going to get more complex. It's going to get more costly, and so we don't drop things just because they're difficult, but it's finding the best way to bring the parties together and make something possible. I've never seen, you know, I see issues all the time where the politics are real heavy, and they're very heavy on this, and we have to deal with the reality of what's there. I'm not saying any that I favor a particular approach, but it is going to take us finding a way to move ahead where people can talk to each other and we can actually address issues. That isn't a lecture to anybody.
No, except Madam Chair, and I agree.
I just want to see progress made. It's too important. Senator?
And maybe if I just a quick response, because I have not been here. And I agree with that. And, of course, I think, and as you attended all the task force meetings, I think the work session we had, Madam Chair, most of them.
Yeah.
And I think that's exactly what we were doing. It was an open process, and despite the fact that the chair may not be on the committee, she participated, and other folks were welcome, and the provider community and the insurance industry participated as much as they wanted to, and you, Commissioner, were invited to participate as much as you wanted to. So it was a very open process, and one where we tried to bring consensus, and I think there was not a lot of hostility and anger in that process. I thought we worked very, very well working together.
Fine. Thank you very much, Commissioner. Had there been anyone else to speak, or have we, I hope, afforded an opportunity? It was excellent testimony that we received this morning. I'm just going to make one final note before we leave. I'm recessing the meeting until 10:45. We'll attempt to catch all of the committee members, because I would like to take action on committee substitute for Senate Bill 74 Hess. We just got it. We're reviewing it to see if it agreed with the comments that we sent over. So we will recess the committee until 10:45. So, committee back to order. We are not on teleconference, and we sent the bill over. There's just one change that on page, what we are looking at, the committee substitute for Senate Bill number 74 Hess. It is reflective of the discussion we had yesterday, and staff has checked that with one exception. That is on page 2, line 14. Melissa, can you tell us what we have here?
Yes, Madam Chairman, for the record, I'm Melissa Faust, staff to the Senate Hess Committee. The Director of the Division of Insurance and the Commissioner of Administration have requested in this bill and in other bills that the exclusion of the director or his designee from being reimbursed by the association to be removed from the bill. And although we didn't instruct the drafter to do that, I think that it's something the committee more or less decided was a good idea.
So that would read, members of the board be reimbursed?
The director or his designee may be reimbursed. Or may.
No.
Right.
It would, what would we
oh,
take out other than the director or his designee?
No, you take out members of the board other than.
Well, members
of the board
may
be reimbursed from the association for expenses.
Uh-huh.
All right, let's figure this out. They would like it to leave them out.
They would like for the director and his designee to be able to get expenses reimbursed.
So read the sentence. You take out the words "members of the board other than," and then just start the sentence with "the director" and read the whole sentence.
Well, then what about the members of the board if you start it with "the directors"?
Talking about fees?
Yeah. Well, then you have to rewrite a whole sentence. I thought they may have been
members of the board may be reimbursed from the association, and that would include the director or his designee.
But may not be otherwise compensated. I see.
Okay, that would do it then. If you took just members of the board, took out "other than," and
the
then
director or the director's
designee. Take out
starting with "other than," take out "other than the director or the director's designee."
Right. Would then read, "members of the board may be reimbursed."
Right, from the association.
So move.
We have an amendment. Well, what we better do is adopt the committee substitute.
Madam Chair, I move that we adopt the CS for Senate Bill 74.
Do I hear discussion? Objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Senator Menard.
Then, Madam Chair, I make the motion.
We have a motion before us to delete on page 2, line 14, "other than the director or the director's designee." Discussion? Objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Prepared?
Yeah, Madam Chair,
I have one question. That one issue about clarifying the number of votes to pass things, can you take care of that?
That was a different bill.
Oh, it was a different bill?
Yeah, I think that was 2.
Well, how was that addressed in this? What was that? How was that addressed in this bill?
I don't think this issue does. I don't know that we changed that, Senator Hoffman. What may have to do is you may have to catch that one in finance. I think that was on Senate bill.
This one has some kind of elaborate weighted vote.
Yeah, they vote to weight their votes.
Page 2.
So it talks about weighted vote, but it doesn't talk about what is needed to pass that weighted vote.
Madam Chair, I make the motion that we move CS Senate Bill 74 from committee with individual recommendation.
Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Meeting adjourned.